welcome to Railway Mania. What you're about to hear is part two of our double bill episode where Nick Richardson and I discuss the collieries and coal railways of northeast England. In part one, we talked about the history of coal mining in this area, but now we shall be looking more closely at three distinct railway systems. Hope you enjoy it. Let's talk about some of the colliery railway systems. We talked a little bit about how the whole area was dependent on this stuff, but there were lots of distinct systems there, and depending on which colliery owned them or, you know, what kind of methods they were using to transport it. So if we could talk about the Bowes Railway to begin with.
Okay, so Bowes, it opened initially in the 1820s. It was laid down by George Stephenson, and it used locomotive haulage, self-acting incline and stationary engines to move coal over about 15 miles when it was fully working.
What kind of terrain is that?
So effectively, it goes from Dipton in the west, which is slightly downhill, and then you go up to the top of the Teme Valley, down towards Kibblesworth, where there was another colliery, down to the bottom of the Teme Valley, underneath the East Coast Main Line, up to Birkheads, up again, so you're now on the eastern side of the Teme Valley, and you're now at Black Fell, up to Blackham's Hill, which is heading towards Springwell, and then down from Blackham's Hill to Springwell Colliery, down from Springwell to Springwell Bank Foot, where locomotives took the rest of the train to Jarrow, which would have been about 3 miles.
So this is a Big Dipper kind of...
Yeah, it basically goes from west to east.
And are they trying to go more or less as the crow flies?
Ish. It sort of follows the topography, and actually it follows where the collieries were.
Okay.
So it's not a straight line. The first part of the line went from the colliery at Springwell down to Springwell Bank Foot, and then over to Wardley and into Jarrow to a stave that was open. That part was a self-acting incline. So the bit from Springwell Colliery to Springwell Bank Foot, which would have been about maybe a mile, you use the weight of the full wagons to pull the empty ones up.
Is this a double track railway?
It's in some parts it's got four lines. Mostly it's only got three tracks. Because the centre rail is shared.
Oh, so three individual rails?
Yeah, so the centre rail is shared.
Huh.
And it opens up at the meets, which is what it's called, to two double tracks and then closes in again.
Right.
So you only need three sets of rails to operate two trains.
So the centre track, the flanges are on either side.
Yes.
So the up line is one side of the rail and the down line is the other side of the rail.
It's really difficult to try and get it across in a podcast. The thing to do is watch Bowes Line. Bowes Line was commissioned by the NCB in around 74, 75, and it shows the last part of the railway running from Kibblesworth, which is on the west side of the Teme Valley, all the way down to Jarrow, and it follows a train of hoppers all the way down. And you can see the men working the ropes, and you can see how it was worked. And how can I describe it? It's pretty agricultural.
Why use this? Why not just hook it up onto a loco and take it all the way?
The gradients are too steep.
Okay.
And you probably need less locomotives than one stationary engine. One stationary engine, fixed infrastructure, that's it.
Is that cheap, then?
Cheap-ish.
Mm. Comparatively to a locomotive, comparatively, which must be a huge capital expense.
Yeah, and I guess in 1826, stationary engines are probably more reliable than steam locomotives, and steam locomotives can't pull trucks up banks that are really steep. I was a volunteer at Bowes in the 80s. My dad went up. I asked him about this recently, actually. He said about 79, 80, when it was just taking off as a preservation society, and he wasn't especially taken by the rope pull side of it, and neither was I, to be fair. I wanted to be around steam engines.
Yeah.
And there were two. There was number 22. She'd been bought new for the railway in the 1940s, and Andrew Barclay. And my dad said she was the better of the two engines. The other one was WST, and my dad helped do things like put vacuum brakes on 22 and WST. And Springwell Colliery, which was kind of the centre of the Bowes Railway, had a full engineering workshop. Wheel lathe, engineering shops, joiner's shop, and a wagon shop that had originally been a coal store, because there'd been a colliery at Springwell for a long time. When the colliery closed, there'd been this really heavy buttressed building that had been used to put coal in the summer to stockpile it. And it was turned into the wagon shops, mm-hmm. with a couple of roads and forges, drop hammers, and what was affectionately referred to as the man killer by Mr. Stobart, Ozzy Stobart, the guy who kind of led the locomotive side of life, a 4-foot blade on a circular saw.
Oh my word.
Because they built and maintained their own wagons.
And there's so much wood, timber used in the construction of the wagons. Yeah.
So you've got self-acting inclines, as I say, where full wagons pull empties up and all you really need is a big wheel and a brake.
So you're only overcoming...
gravity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when you see Bow's Line, and you'll see this being done, they move quite quickly. Stationary engines, where you have up to 12 hoppers being put on the end of a rope and dropped maybe a mile down into
a yard. These ropes must have been enormous.
Like, from memory, they were probably inch and a half.
And how long?
Well, they must have been as long as the line, so that... thinking about it, reeling it, the drums were pretty big. It's a long time since I've been in the Hall of House in Blackham's Hill, but they were pretty substantial. And Blackham's Hill was the one that's still part of the preserved railway, and we'll talk about that in a minute, was unique in that it allowed wagons to be worked down an east and a west incline at the same time.
So you're kind of at the summit?
Yeah, there. You are. Okay. And the western incline is much steeper than the eastern side. So a set of wagons at Bow's was 12 wagons, but they only ever worked half sets up the west incline because it was too steep. And again, when you see them working ropes, there are fixed installations, I suppose is the best way to describe it, in each sort of bank foot is what it would be called, or bank head.
So bank head being the summit.
Yeah, and bank foot being the bottom end.
The receiving yard.
Yeah, there was a kip and a dish. A kip is a hump,
okay,
and a dish is a depression in the track, and that was to allow the slack to be taken off the rope so it could be pulled out of the way of the wagons.
Oh, yeah, because if it's under tension, how on earth do you disconnect it?
And you see in Bow's Line them using what looks to me like a Blake riding slip off a ship, the kind of thing you use a ship's anchor, and they pull a pin out and knock a retaining pin, and the whole assembly falls away, and a man has a big long iron, sort of almost like a fire iron, and he pulls the rope out of the way in front of the moving wagons,
so it doesn't get caught under the wheels, etc. Yeah, et cetera.
Until that was introduced, and I can't quite remember when it was, but it was around about the 50s or 60s, and I have a theory. I think somebody went away to sea during the war or something and saw this and thought, that'll do just right at smashing. Because until then, there were set riders that were on the front of the wagons, and their job was to slip the ropes at the bank foots and the bank heads.
Imagine that as your job. In all weathers as well.
Absolutely.
You're just riding on the front of a train that has no locomotive.
Yeah.
And your job is to take the slack off the rope that's holding you.
Yeah, once the slack's off the rope, you've got to take the rope off the set.
My God.
And the other job they had was fire baskets. They had to put a fire basket on the back of the set, a bit like a tail lamp.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a wire that ran down some of the banks that if there was a problem, the set rider had to jump off and pull the wire, and it would set off a rapper, which was basically like a big bell, to say there was a problem. And you see pictures of, you know, guys, PPE, a flat cap, big long, you know, Macintosh Macs and big mufflers and everything else. Absolutely incredible. The railway closed in the 1970s when Kibblesworth Colliery shut. And so what happened was that the line from Kibblesworth down to Jarrow was still being used. And it was decided to try and preserve part of the railway. And the bit that was preserved was from a place called Black Fell down to the yard in Springwell. And at the top of the line at Blackham's Hill, there is a hauler with an electric motor in it. It had been steam until the 1940s, and I think there was somebody out there will tell me I've got this wrong, but I think what had happened was that there was a crack in the bed plate of the steam locomotive that had been there for a long time, and they replaced it with a Thompson Houston electric motor, basically driving a drum. All there is an indicator on a bar that goes up and down, and there's a pointer comes along and it says you're in the right place, or that's the level crossing, or that's where.
So that's your only method of telling where the train is?
Basically.
An estimation based on the length of the rope that you've played out?
Yeah, effectively.
Okay.
And the rope was changed periodically to, you know, and things would have to be reset and whatever. And there's a huge amount of skill running alongside a set of loaded hoppers on old creosoted sleepers, dropping brakes. Now, it's going to sound a bit corny, but you pin down brakes by literally lifting the brake, putting it down and putting a brake stick in and putting a pin in. Now, as a 14-year-old lad, I was doing that sort of thing under supervision, I must say, of Ozzy Stobart, the man who had been around pits and locomotives since he was about 14. And if you got it wrong, he told you.
In no uncertain terms.
Yeah, yeah, I think once he said, if you lose your post again, I'll tan your arse. Which was, and I got stuck in the tank of number 22. I was a bit smaller and younger. Again, I was at 13 or 14, and we were cleaning out the muck and rubbish that had got in the bottom of the water tank. And you had to go in and then under the baffles, because obviously the tank's got baffles to stop it surging. And I got stuck, and Ozzy put his head in and he went, if you can't get out, it's the gossax. And so for those of you who don't understand what I've just said, if you can't get out, I will have to get the oxyacetylene torch. I got out. The preserved railway is unique in many ways because it's got the wagons that were used to move the coal in situ in the railway they were built for.
Were these internal user wagons only? They weren't designed for running anywhere else on the network.
They were, and well, a long time ago, some of the wagons were being used to run coal to London from a colliery at a place called Usworth, but that stopped. And by the time I knew it, the railway was just to the stays that the NCB had at Jarrow, and it was a fairly big installation.
So it's a pretty self-contained system by that point.
Yeah, I've got in my notes here, at its peak, the railway handled 1 million tonnes of coal a year and was virtually intact till 1968, really. It was also said that 200 men could move 1 million tonnes, and one set of 12 wagons that went from one end of the railway to the other made enough money to pay for the wages of all those men.
I think that really puts it in perspective, because if everything from that point on is running cost and profit, you can see why they went to these lengths to do it. We see why they put all this infrastructure in ship this substance.
The wagon shops in Springwell had the ability to rebuild and build their own wagons. And if you see the bearers and the sort of the size of the planks, that's why we go back to the huge circular saws.
The man killer.
Yeah, the man killer. And big swages that a blacksmith had come up with to do a specific job on a spring hanger or whatever. They also had some really specialised wagons. At Kibblesworth, all the shunting was done with a little cable hauled, what was called the Kibblesworth Drift Bogey, and it was like a two-plank, one-plank wagon with a little shelter on it and a wrapper. And again, you'll see it on Bowes Line, and when it moves, it goes clang, clang, clang. And that had been rebuilt from a wagon that was ancient. And if you look at the wagons at Bowes and you look at some of the axle boxes, some of them say Northeastern Railway. I think I've seen some that say Stockton and Darlington.
Wow.
They've got, and they bought wagons from the Northeastern Railway. They bought them from Watts Hardy.
So they were old when they were new to the line.
Yeah, they were. Some of them were new.
You got Trigger's wagon.
Pretty much. And, you know, some of the wagons just lost in time, really. They had the local coal bogies. Anything that was not a hopper was a bogie. And Geordie Lurker, curl bogie. And it was a 4 or 5 plank high wagon that was just used for locomotive coal to the sheds, because there was a shed at Marley Hill, which is now where the Tanfield Railway is.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Tanfield Railway itself was actually a national network railway. It was a freight branch.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bows crossed it on the flat, on a flat crossing, just outside the engine shed. And there was another one at Springwell Bankfoot. They even had a snowplough.
Of course, because you're not going to run any locos up there. You didn't want the wagons rolling down the hill and running to a snowdrift.
No, absolutely not. I think the thing about Bows is that when I was a volunteer as a young man, even then, it took a lot of people to run the operation, because in order to get people to see what was going on at Blackham's Hill, you've got to run a passenger train.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's continuously brake trains in a colliery environment with all the requirements for safety and one engine and steam working and whatever, which made it complicated.
You're running two systems, one on top of the other.
Absolutely. And the railways had some difficult times recently, I think. That said, I think the wagon shops were recently re-roofed. I was able to speak to some of the volunteers. I went up and took some dimensions of some wagons, and they were all very enthusiastic. and had a look round the scene of the crime where my dad dropped a spanner on my nose when I was about 14. We were taking apart the belly bands that keep the sheathing on the bottom of the boiler.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in the pit, and he dropped this dirty, great big spanner on my nose.
I think they had a few problems with scrap metal thieves as well.
Yeah.
Because I think once you've got that much cable on site and someone knows about it, they're going to want to get their hands on it.
I think it was more that at Black Fell, although there was no incline left, there was a complete hauler.
Mm.
And it had the motor and everything in it. And they got in and stripped it all out.
Oh, my God.
And I think that has been repurposed as a community space, but I'm right on the edge of my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that there is an aspiration to get the railway running for the 200th anniversary in 2026.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hope that there are enough people out there who will help to make that happen, because it should be the jewel in the crown of the North East Preserved Colliery Railways, because I think it's a scheduled ancient monument.
Wow.
But that it's always had issues with where it is. It's starting to be encroached by a bit of development. Of course, you know, during the pandemic, everybody walked, and if there'd been no trains running, people will use it as a footpath.
Yeah, that's happened in a lot of places.
Yeah, and you can also imagine the health and safety associated with putting 12 unbraked wagons on the end of a rope.
Well, a lot of this stuff, you find, if you've never stopped doing it, it's fine. But as soon as you stop and you have to recertify for it, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, I would like to think that they'll get away with grandfather rights. I was listening to one of your podcasts about unrebuilding a bullied Pacific, and they spoke about that, didn't they?
Yeah,
and that was fascinating.
Yeah, because it was fine then, it will be fine now.
Yeah. Bows, in many ways as well, when you look at the way it was preserved, anything that wasn't original was painted blue. So all the brake vans are all Bows blue.
Mm-hmm.
And that was down to the sort of the team that brought it back to life in the early, well, late 70s, early 80s, I guess. They're really lucky. Number 22 is an original locomotive for the Bows Railway. They've also got wagons from other railways at the moment. And speaking to some of the guys I know through my father in North Tyneside, they are, I think one or two of them have gone to other places. I know that North Tyneside, for example, have got some Lambton rolling stock now. But they're mostly 10-ton wooden hoppers running with unbraked trains, and, you know, crash and bang. And you can see the skill needed to manage this stuff. My dad, I remember the first time I ever went on a footplate, I was about nine, and I was put in the corner of the cab of 22 by Ozzy Stobart, and he said, "Sit there, touch note, it's all hot," which again means sit there, don't touch anything, it's warm. And I spent the entire day going up and down.
Magic.
Absolutely. And I think my dad was starting to learn how to dry fire and that kind of thing. And I do remember him being told to get ahead of it or we'll be away. We'll be a main. We'll run away. And again, going back to what we're talking about, sort of working up with your mate, you watched out. And I do remember one guy got injured once and he'd done something to his finger and everything stopped. And it was like, we've got an injured man. Get him down, get him sorted out. And you can see the guys that had worked in those kind of environments, what was important and what wasn't. You know, the man's health was more important than moving this truck.
Mm.
Yeah, and what I would also say about Bows Line is that the guys that are talking in it are really broad.
So if you want to view this, it's on YouTube.
It's
B-O-W-E-S,
yes,
Line.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And it's all in colour as well, I think. Well, that's brilliant about it. You're seeing this archaic railway operating in colour footage.
In 1974 or 75.
This is after the end of BR Steam.
Yeah, and watch out for some of the guys that are working, because they all look like they're dressed like ex-BR engine men. If you notice, they've got greasy top caps on. One or two of them are wearing bib and braces. Mm. So part of me wonders, did they get a job on another railway when the shed shut?
Mm.
And there is an interesting part where they're talking about where do you go to vote, if you can understand what they're saying. And at one point, the guy says, I'm getting, I think it's £750 after 39 years service. It's not very much money, is it? And those bait cabins, right? A bait cabin is like a mess hut. Geordie term for lunch is your bait. So they're all called bait cabins. Right. Did you not know that?
I didn't know that.
Bait.
Is this something to do with fishing?
No, no, it's not. It's bait. You bait. You know how we have bait time? And you can see them making the tea and putting those pies into the oven.
Oh, yes.
And those bait cabins are still there. And each crossing cabin had either a hut or a cabin where the lads were. And Blackham's Hill, I lived in closer to South Shields, maybe 4 or 5, 6, 7 miles away. It might be frosty on a Saturday morning when we were going up there when I was 12, 13. There'd be 4 inches, 5 inches, a foot of snow at Springwell and Blackham's Hill because it's the only high ground after, well, it kind of goes Ural Mountains, North Sea, South Shields Beach, you know, and it gets a bit cold. So they were hard men, I think. And Ozzy Stobart, I remember him being very lithe and very fit, thin and really wiry and very strong. Yeah, it was. He used a shunt. Did you see them using shunters poles? You've ever tried doing it?
When you see someone who knows to use a shunters pole and how they balance their body and their weight, but they've got so much. It's like ballerina strength almost. Yeah. Do you know, they are strong, but they're not like bodybuilder.
Easy enough to uncouple. It's difficult to couple up.
And they also have their timing right. You know, they know exactly when wagons are going to bump into each other, when the chain's going to go slack, when, you know, when to get out of the way, that kind of stuff, because they've just done it so much.
Oh, incredible, really.
I think it's sad, but I think it's also, it highlights something that's really important, is working exhibits and preserving methods of using machinery and artifacts is so important. Yes, museums are great in preserving the artifacts themselves, but preserving working practices, once you lose it, it's gone.
Yeah, I do. I know I spoke with one guy who now goes to North Tyneside or the Stevenson Railway Museum, who was a hauler driver, and he must be in his 70s as a volunteer. And there can't be many people in preservation that have driven the hauler. Ask a few questions like, how do you do this? He said, well, there's a certain part where you've got to put the brake on so you take the tension off the rope so you can hear the lads slipping the couplings and all this kind of thing. So it is a really, it's almost military precision. Mm. You know, if you get it wrong, it's going to go Pete Tong. If the wagons overrun the rope, that's not going to be good.
No.
And I never saw it happen. But what is... For me, a sound of the past is the whine of the rope on the roller when it's going along. And having been at sea and being told never cross a rope or a wire that's being worked, these guys are doing it all the time.
Oh, it's mad. And we use a capstan with the museum just to shunt a few wagons and put down as part of a demonstration. And we have to be really, really careful about it because obviously it's a rope.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of tension on it and stuff, but... And also, like, when we're sort of docking the museum ships and stuff, like the tugboats and stuff that we have in the museum. And then you watch videos of people docking stuff, and they've got, like, their legs around the capstan with the rope winding through the middle of their legs and stuff like that. And you're like, what are you doing?
You just get
like,
shouted at.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. There are still parts of the railway that, in Springwell Yard, there are small haulers as well that they used to use to move wagons around, and I remember the bottom end of the wagon shops was always a bit ropey, and you had to be really careful shunting down there because you could run away and slide. And I remember there being a couple of hairy moments again when I was younger. And I don't know today how you could do things safely. I think you'd have to treat it as a very formulaic, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to tabletop.
Well, you certainly
first.
Don't figure it out on the day.
No, definitely not. It's too difficult. It would all go wrong, and you really need to have 6 or 12 wagons, all the brakes work. There was the guy that they used as an honorary traction inspector when I was a younger guy. It was a fella called Harry Friend, and he wrote a number of articles that went into something like Railway World a long time ago, and he did have a little book published with all his anecdotes. But he said that he'd worked out of Tyne Dock and Consett on the ore trains.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, stories that he tells about trains running away and him getting it wrong. But he said, we always had good boilers and good brakes.
Yes. And you need to go and need to stop.
Absolutely, yeah. But, yeah, Bose is interesting. You know, hopefully it will get the attention that it deserves to bring it back to life, and you can showcase what it is. It is a really unique system.
So 1826.
That was the first part of the railway.
And then it closed when?
No, let's get this right. It was either, I think it was 74 or 76.
So it outlasted so many of the more sort of modern railways that ended up surrounding it. And steam locomotive haulage really outlasted.
It did, but they were using diesels on the locomotive haul sections. There were sort of locomotive haul sections at either end of the line.
Mm-hmm.
The western end, it was quite vicious. The bank to get from Burnett Field up towards Dipton, Hobson Bank, was quite severe. So that was quite a heavy turn. But they were taking trains on the locomotive haul section from Springwell Bank Foot all the way through past Moncton Coalworks down to the stays at Jarrow. And I think what happened was Kibblesworth Colliery closed at the same time that the NCB lost a contract for power station coal. So what they did was they truncated the railway at Moncton, because the Moncton Coalworks was part of the Bowes system.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, we were talking about integrated transport systems. At one point, they were mining the coal and taking it to their own coalworks and then exporting the coke.
Yep.
And the coalworks shut about 84-ish, I think. And it was truncated and it became Moncton Railways. And you might see in preservation Moncton on some wagons.
Right.
Because as the collieries closed, a lot of the wagons were moved around to different places. And North Tyneside Steam Railway have got a Moncton wagon.
Okay.
I speak to one of the guys up there and we talk about liveries. They were able to match some of the original paint to a paint
can
sample.
Can you tell he's a modeller?
I've got the colour back in the workshop and I'll have to ask him again. But I do have a drawing that he gave me from 1957, I think it is, that says the standard colour was Venetian red and there's a British standard code beside it. I've also heard Bowes wagons painted vermilion,
mm-hmm.
chestnut,
mm-hmm.
And when I've sort of tried to get an idea of what the right colour is, most people go, well, it was just whatever we had, whatever we were given. It was NCB.
It was the colour that was in the pot at the time.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But Venetian red, I think Phoenix Precision do a Venetian red, Rail Match. Not being able to get hold of any. I've got some red oxide, which seems to be really close to the colour that I got from the guys at North Tyneside.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a subtly different colour to the colour that they're painting the wagons at Tanfield from Lambton. And knowing the way that the Tanfield guys will have worked, that will be as close to original as possible as well. So, you know, it's like Doncaster green and Darlington green, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the shade of sunlight on the day.
Yes.
Depends quite a lot. Well, the longevity of this system, I mean, it lasted for so long in operation.
The NCB weren't going to change it if it worked.
No, exactly.
And if you've got a fixed installation that's still working, you know, a hauler or a brake cabin and a big wheel and a rope,
mm-hmm.
well, it's effectively free because you can repair it all yourself.
Yeah.
Just the cost of the materials.
Yeah. Just those stats that you say about one trainload of coal paying for everybody's wages for that day. Let's talk about one of the next systems. So this might be one that people have heard quite a lot about, which is the Lambton Railway.
Right, the Lambton Railway was a completely different proposition, really, to Bowes. It was on the south side of the River Weir and had grown out of collieries that were owned by Lord Lambton and others. He was originally J.G. Lambton, later the Earl of Lambton. He purchased a wagonway in about 1820, and that allowed him to get from his collieries at Burnmore and Philadelphia to the River Weir. The original railway went over using stationary engines.
Why is it called Philadelphia?
That's a good one. I read it's because when they were laying out the collieries in around about the time of the American War of Independence, somebody had an affinity to the Americans and called it Philadelphia.
How strange.
I always wondered if it was the other way around, but that's what I read recently.
Huh.
The railway followed very much the fortunes of the North Eastern Railway. So in 1850, the North Eastern Railway was formed and it took control of the Darlington-Newcastle main line. And at the time, the main line ran from Durham through a place called Fencehouses to a place called Penshire, spelt Penshaw, but if you're from that, it's Penshire. And it crossed the river on the Victoria Viaduct and went over and joined up and went to Newcastle that way, called the Leamside Line, known as the Old Main Line. Now, Philadelphia and the Lambton collieries are very close to Pensha. And in 1865, the Northeastern Railway decided to put a branch on the south side of the river to join up at Pensha through a place called Cox Green, Hilton, Pallion, into Sunderland itself, which meant the staves that Lambton was using already on the weir, he could get to by getting running rights over the newly built Northeastern Railway branch.
So in comparison to Bowes, which is almost a self-contained system from, like, you know, Pithead to
this
the
is
docks,
different.
This is a system that's split up and has to use a different railway, the yeah. Northeastern Railway Company,
yeah,
to connect its various more port and pits.
Yeah, you've got private sidings at the staves in Sunderland, mm-hmm. the Lambton drops, and you've got a whole massive complex of locomotive sheds, collieries, including a section of main line that goes beside the Northeastern Railway's line. If you've ever seen the Fence Houses model railway, you can see it's like four tracks. So two of them are owned by the Lambton Railway and two of them are owned by the Northeastern Railway.
I think that's one of the other things to get across about the Lambton is that it was almost one of the closest things you get into in the UK is to an industrial main line.
Yeah.
They were using big locomotives.
They were.
They had double track running.
They did. And you can sort of see the development following the stuff we talked about earlier about the demand for coal peaking. And around about 1904, Mr. Tulip, who was the chief engineer at Lambton, was looking at his trains. And what the problem was, they were using old Northeastern and some locomotives they'd built themselves in their own workshops, mostly 060 tender engines that were considered to be a bit underpowered. And, you know, looking at the literature I found earlier, you know, he's saying it was 120 pounds in pressure and it wasn't man enough for the job. They were a bit concerned about what they were going to replace them with because a tender engine gives you extra braking power. And remember, these are unbraked trains, although they did have a guard in a brake van. But they were Lambton Railway guards and Lambton Railway built brake vans. So they looked to the South Wales coalfield. What are they using to move coal there? Short haul mainline coal, the 062 tank engine.
So like the Rhymney Railway, the Barrow Railway, Taff Vale, all yeah. of them are using 062s.
Yeah. They, yeah,
so this
much.
Is a big tank engine.
It's a big chunky tank engine. It's got some advantages over the older Northeastern locomotives. One, it's got an enclosed cab, so the crew are better protected from the weather.
Yeah, I heard it gets quite cold.
Yeah, well, the Sunderland drops are close to the mouth of the river and the wind whips through there. It cuts you like a knife. There is something to talk about cabs. The tunnel to get to the staves or the drops or whatever you want to call them was very restricted. And you see all the Lambton locomotives that were used there that have got a very small cab. And the profile of the wagons and of the brake vans just about allows them to go through a very narrow bore tunnel.
So quite tight clearances then?
Very.
And again, that ties into that efficiency thing. You want to get the maximum amount of coal through that tunnel that you possibly can.
Yeah, well, I think it was pre-existing. It'd been used from the 1850s and stuff was smaller. But what is really unique about these locomotives is that they were so successful. 1904, the first one was built by Kitson, number 29, and she's preserved. 160 PSI at the time, apparently 4.5 foot driving wheels, about 2.5 tons of coal. So they're fairly substantial locomotives. The crews that worked them were passed out by Northeastern LNER, British Railway traction inspectors.
Is that because they had to run over Northeastern Railway
metals? They ran over National Network metals. So this is a colliery system that at its height, when it amalgamated later on with the Hetton Colliery, had about 70 miles of track and 50 locomotives and its own engineering workshops, brass foundries, metal foundries, engineering, you know, machine shops, built its own wagons, running 400-ton trains to two sets of staves. So we move on a bit, segue into, in the 1920s, the Lambton collieries amalgamated with Hetton to become Lambton, Hetton and Joycey Colliery.
So that's why you see LHJC
yes.
on the side of 29.
Oh, now that's a good one. When I was little, there was a Lambton, Hetton and Joycey Colliery locomotive at Beamish. It's the same loco, I think it's now, it's at Tanfield. And I got a postcard of it and I went to see my gran and I didn't know what that meant. And she went, it's Lambton, Hetton and Joycey Colliery's. And I was really impressed, thinking, how did my gran know that? And I was about six. Well, of course she knew it because she'd grown up around there and her father was a miner. But the Hetton Railway also had its own staves. for a long time, they were close together on the river, but not physically connected until the amalgamation and another tunnel was put in so you could access both sets of staithes from the British Railways line as well as the Hetton Railway. In later times, the Lambton Railway also ran trains to South Dock. Now, South Dock had been developed by George Hudson in the 1850s. George Hudson, the railway king, he had a lot to do with the York and North Berwick Railway that was the predecessor to the North Eastern. And in fact, if you go to Sunderland today, Monk Weymouth Station, which was Monk Weymouth Station Museum when I was a kid, it's now the Sunderland Football Club. It's either their museum or their shop. It's a really fancy building. It's almost mock Georgian.
Right.
Because it's the original terminus and the railway was extended over the river. And the Lambton and Hetton drops, the Hetton drops were really high. They're said to be the fastest running ones in the northeast. Which goes back to this sort of conversation about breaking coal. Well, clearly they weren't bothered. If they were really fast loading, maybe there was a different way of doing it. Certainly, South Dock was opened in order to provide the North Eastern Railway with their own unloading facilities. Because Lambton have got their own staithes.
And they don't want to share.
No, Hetton don't. Further down the coast in Seaham, the Londonderry Railway, Seaham Harbour, is because Londonderry wants his own staithes. You go to the Tyne, you've got Bowes has got its own staithe. The Peelow Main Colliery has got its own staithe. The Heart and Coal Company's got its own staithe. But what is interesting about South Dock is that they were savvy to the need to watch out for breakage and handle decent coal. And they had some fairly sophisticated coal handling machinery that allowed you to put a northeastern hopper or hopper wagon with a bottom door onto almost like a cradle that could be swung out over a ship.
So it's kind of a gentle drop rather than the Hetton drops, which are as fast as you can get it out, get it into the boat.
Well, I mean, I've never seen any film of the Lambton or the Hetton drops being used. Although my dad or his father was a merchant navy and worked out of Sunderland and Newcastle. And my dad said, when you crossed the river on the footbridge that's parallel to the railway bridge, it was always grimy. There was always coal dust under your feet. You can't really tell now, but when I was a kid, again, going back to the stuff we discussed, all the stone was always black.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's unique about Lambton is, saying before, they built their own locomotives.
Well, they had a penchant for rebuilding as
well. Yeah, they did.
They really cared about modernisation.
Recycling, effectively. Yeah. Upcycling.
Some locos, like you say, they built their own ones, but they look like Victorian engines. And then later on, they come to have really modern cabs put on them.
Well, they look like a standard. Isn't there a picture of an 060 Tender engine that looks...
It's like got a streamlined cab on it.
It looks like a standard tank engine almost.
Yeah. It's like someone's welded two models together. And you think if you built a model of that, then no one would believe you that it was real. And you say, no, look, massive windows, but glazed as well. Like you say, it's grim up north.
steady.
Weather protection is important. And those things are running tender first half the time, so they've got tender cabs too.
I mean, the other thing as well is that this was a fully signal system.
Right. Do you get the impression that it was running at capacity most of the time?
That's an interesting question.
Because like we said about, they wouldn't have wanted to share their staithes and they probably didn't have any capacity to.
I think they probably got to a point where they were steady state, where they knew what they needed to do. Mm. And if they needed to move more coal, they'd just move more coal. I've seen literature that said that, you know, you had about 30 minutes to drop your train off at the staithes, water, run round and get ready to go. But you could do it in 10 if you had it all sorted out.
Shift on.
And that's because I think, and I don't know, that the crews were probably paid by how much coal they moved.
That was the case on Liverpool and Manchester in the early days. You did get paid per trip.
Right, okay.
I don't know if it was a carryover from that.
Possibly. You know, different parts of the world had different working practices, didn't they?
Mm.
I think we discussed this. There's a really good article on one of the websites, but I think
it was Lambton Locomotives Trust. Yeah, it was on.
I think it's an Industrial Railway Society article, and it's called Running an Edwardian Railway, written by a guy called Colin Mountford, who's written extensively about colliery railways. And another good book of his is The Private Railways of County Durham. But some of the things, everybody says how fantastic the Lambton tanks were. Well, at first they weren't. They were breaking rails, and the North Eastern Railway were not happy about that. They were being overloaded, and so I suppose it's a bit like introducing anything new. Everybody goes, oh, the old stuff was better.
It's
terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also corresponded with his counterpart in the North Eastern Railway in wherever it was to say, you're not giving our trains enough precedent. They're waiting too long for your trains to
pass. I guess what's fantastic about that is it was all by letter.
Yeah.
And he kept copies of everything. Yeah. And you can see he was polite, to the point. And everything was about efficient running, don't hold up the coal trains. Whatever you do, do not hold up the coal trains. It must get through. And like you're saying about the turnaround times at the terminus, I think a lot of people have got an idea about industrial railways because of the footage that survives from the last days of industrial steam, that it's quite dilapidated and the engines creak along broken track and things like that. This is as close to a mainline railway as you can get in an industrial environment.
Yeah, I think even at the pictures of the permanent way in the 50s, 60s, it wasn't badly maintained at all. It was all ash ballast, you know, and bullhead rail, all neat and tidy. And the pictures inside the signal boxes, they're all polished, and the lino's polished, and the guys took pride in their place of work.
Mm.
You know, and I guess it's about, if you paint a signal white, it's only going to stay white a certain amount of time in that environment, isn't it? Mr. Tulip, the same guy, was responsible for modernising the wagon fleet because the Northeastern Railway basically said you can't run black wagons, cauldrons over our metals.
Because isn't there a distinction between wagons with two G's and wagons? So with the two G's, one refers to the old style of, like, you know, the horse-drawn kind of type of like the cauldron kind of.
That's
wagons.
Interesting because I always, this might just be a Nickism, but a Bose wagon is a WAGGON wagon.
Right.
But it might just be.
Do you think that's a carryover of nomenclature from sort of the days of yore, when they would have been using that?
The other issue was in this sort of transition between older and new, that the older wagons and the newer ones, they had the headstocks and stanchions were extended down for the dumb buffers of the older.
Oh, so you had a transitional period.
Yeah, yeah. And they were smashing stanchions and putting wagons out of commission, which was causing issues because if you don't have enough wagons, trucks, whatever you want to call them, you can't shift the coal.
So what's the answer then? Like wholesale replacement?
Well, again, there's a letter that basically said there was a problem with marshalling of two types in the same train, resulting in frequent complaints from Lambton Staithes and the Northeastern about the time it took to sort out a mixed train. So on the 9th of January 1905, Mr. Tulip issued a notice to his locomotive men, two locomotive crew and guard per train. After this date, when making up trains, either loaded or empty, care must be taken to have all the box wagons coupled together. They may be placed next the van or next the engine or anywhere in the train, so as long as they are all together. The Northeastern Railway, which had already decreed that all 4-ton wagons with double G would be banned from their liners from the 1st of January 1914, later tried to have trucks put next to the guards van only, but this was successfully resisted. So effectively, he's saying, fellas, you need to sort things out so we don't smash wagons.
Do you think that is a case at the unloading point that the two types of wagon couldn't be used on the same unloading points? If they're trying to sort out the trains when they arrive?
There might be an element of that as
because
well.
Because I know that there was a big resistance to changing, across the whole coal industry, there's a big resistance to changing the format of a four-wheeled rigid chassis wagon. And that's why we didn't really get much in the way of bogey coal hoppers and that kind of thing, because all of the facilities were built to handle a size of wagon, a consistent size of wagon.
Yeah, I think that's entirely true. I think it's because the screens where wagons were loaded were often from the 1860s and 1870s. It's fixed infrastructure. Coal companies don't want to spend any money. What is interesting is in my quest for accuracy when I'm building models, a lot of Northeastern hoppers are a 10'6" wheelbase, and people go, yeah, so what? Well, most others are 9 and 10 foot, and I wonder if that extra 6 inches was as a reason because it helped the hopper run, or it allowed for more coal in a slightly longer wagon over the headstocks. There must be some reason why the Northeastern went to a 10'6" wheelbase and everybody else.
Maybe if they're using hoppers quite a lot, maybe it's something to do with the drop doors,
yeah,
on the bottom,
quite possibly,
clearance,
yeah,
for the brake gear and everything.
Quite possibly. But what I'm finding is that if I want a 10'6" wheelbase, I have to build it myself, which is dramatic. I mean, what is interesting again is that this has been modelled. Fencehouse's model railway do it, and there are one or two models out there, and I think there's a movement these days, isn't there, for sort of smaller layouts that depict different elements of the hobby, and you would never have thought that you would get ready to run small tank engines like Robert Stevenson Hawthorne or whatever. And you know, I know yourself, you're producing kits for other locomotives like the Bagnalls. So, you know, that's fantastic. But
thank you, Adam.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And we've got in front of us a Lambton Cabbed Austerity, courtesy of Railway Mania. Get yours here.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Checks in the post.
The Lambton system is really interesting because of its size, its complexity.
What was left?
And what is left? Well, not a lot, really. The power station at the Philadelphia complex is still there. It's grade two listed, but not much else. It's all flattened. And when you look, even if you look and go to somewhere like Pensher, we go, there's a farm shop not far away that we use when I go and see my mum and dad. And there's no indication that there were coat works and collieries and railways everywhere. It's just disappeared back into the landscape. And, you know, it's just the way it is. It was a blot on the landscape in many ways, and you don't want to look at horrible brownfield sites that they've been landscaped, you know.
No, I live opposite one. It's just gone. Yeah. And then, of course, we have the two tank engines. They're 2062s. So we've got...
the Lambton tank engines.
Yeah, you've got the Kitson and the RSH. Two different designs, but both 062 Lambton tanks that survive on the North Yorkshire Moors Railway.
Yeah, number 29 and number 5.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting that they switched builders, but they did seem to like the basic concept, and the spec is broadly the same.
I remember them when they were being used in the very early days of the North Yorkshire Moors Railway, and they had NYMR on the sides.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And it was before the time of Aidensfield and Heartbeat and everything else. And my mother is from Yorkshire, that part of the world. So we'd go on holiday to someone like Scarborough, and we'd go onto the North Yorkshire Moors and paddle in the brook down by Goathland and watch the train go by without hordes of tourists wanting to look at Aidensfield. I remember that, and my dad watching trains go by. Yeah, enjoyed that a lot.
It's kind of an iconic look because of that restricted height cab. When you've got the corners rounded off, you've got that very distinctive shape to it.
Well, I was talking to one of the guys at North Tyneside who has got some Lambton stock. He's got one of the plate layers vans. And somebody said to me that there may be a plan for it to visit North Tyneside.
Oh, that'd be nice. And the reunion.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And if there is, I'll hopefully can go up and persuade my dad to let me have a look.
And there's one Lambton Austerity left, which is on the Alne Valley Railway.
Number 60, is that? Yeah, well, it's definitely got the restricted cab, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They just made the cutout a bit bigger because Lambton had quite small doorways on the restricted access cab. And I think for crew comfort and visibility, they've cut the holes to be the same size as a normal austerity. And for some reason, it's got an austerity bunker with the straight sides on it rather than the cut-in bunkers. Getting really nerdy now.
No. I'm very happy. Please carry on.
But moving from a mainline sort of steam railway operation, let's look at the last one on the list. This is the Harton Railway.
The Harton Electric Railway. Okay, so the Harton system developed as a result of the Harton Coal Company modernising its collieries in South Shields in and around the 1890s. Harton Coal Company had five collieries, three in South Shields, St Hilda, Westo and Harton. And it also had Whitburn, which was about 3 miles down the coast. And if anybody knows that part of the world, it's close to Marsden Grotto and Marsden Rock. And it's where everybody goes for an ice cream further down, near Souter Lighthouse, in fact, which is a National Trust landmark. So you can see where it was. It also owned Bolden Colliery. So three collieries in central South Shields. The company had got access to the river by buying previously owned real estate. There was a glassworks in particular that had river frontage, but the issue for the Harton Railway was that in order to get from three sets of exchange sidings effectively down to two sets of stays, and the way I remember it is high stays because they were higher up the river and low stays because they were low down the river.
Okay.
There were really restricted tunnels with really sharp curves. Now, my dad always said the reason they wanted an electric railway in South Shields is because it was genteel. It was where all the sea captains lived, the big merchant navy.
You want those smoky, horrible steam.
Yeah, his dad was a merchant navy officer. He went to sea in the First World War. And nobody wanted the sort of nuisance and smoke associated with railways. Well, I think it's because crews were being overcome in the tunnels by the smoke and the
So the same justification gases as the Woodhead route had for electrification.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah, very similar. And with the demand for coal increasing across the country, they couldn't move it fast enough. So Harton looked to modernise and looked to electricity. And there are some parallels here because in 1909, there was a bill passed, Northern Power Bill, that allowed power distribution to take place in and around the northeast. And there was some resistance from South Shields Council.
I get it.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about that one.
Sorry.
No, oh, I see what you did there. Yeah, yeah, I like that. There was some resistance to this by South Shields Council because it involved digging up roads and things. But when it became apparent to the corporation, I think it was, that they could use it for tramways in the town, they allowed it to take place. And so what the Harton Coal Company did was they went to Seaman Shuckart and electrified an initial part of the railway from the, effectively from the exchange sidings down to the two sets of staves. It proved to be really, really successful. They had effectively mainline locomotives, Bobos.
Is this a DC system? Because the design of the locomotives is kind of like a steeple cab design.
Yeah, they are steeple cab, yeah.
It's similar to the recently announced locomotion models, ES1 type, except for industrial use.
Similar because, of course, the Northeastern Railway was an electric pioneer.
Mm.
This, again, is a bit of an aside, but Raven wanted to electrify the Newcastle-York main line before the First World War got in the way.
It is interesting when you look back and you look at how there was this perception that it would go straight from steam to electric with no in-between, and we've almost had a sort of misstep in history of moving to diesel.
I think there's more to this, and that's because not only did they want to have electric traction on the railway, they wanted to put electric power into their collieries because that then allowed them to run electric winders for the pit head. It also allowed them to put electricity into the pit and run things like electric motors and compressors and
lighting
underground haulers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all perhaps much safer than the technology that existed. What I think is interesting about this is that you have a system that's the height of technological
modernity.
Yeah, right on the cusp. It was like the fighter plane of its day almost.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still using the old-fashioned cauldron wagons because they've
got
them.
What a strange juxtaposition.
Because they've got them, and when you look at the preserved electric that's at North Tyneside E4, you can see the big buffer beam. It almost has an extension underneath the buffers, like a big pad.
And that's the contact with the dumb buffers on the wagons.
Yeah, it is. And you see pictures of the locomotives working, 10.5-ton P4-type Northeastern hoppers, as well as the dumb buffered ones. There were some issues, not least that electrification was so successful that the staves couldn't cope. And
it was too good.
It was too good. And there was a fire in and around 1914, I think it was, that led to them rebuilding the staves. Because by this time, the electric traction had been implemented through all of residential South Shields. But I'll tell you something that is interesting, and I'm going to have to refer to my notes here, because it is one of the stipulations that the council in South Shields gave the coal company when they started to expand. They insisted that the public be screened of all working associated with the business of moving coals. And what did that mean? It meant that the railway was put in very steep cuttings. And so I remember you could hear the trains running, but you couldn't see them, which was really frustrating.
Hidden away from public view.
Yeah.
That's the opposite of an enthusiast's dream.
Absolutely. And if you look at the cutting, let's say there was a really steep bank called Erskine Road that went from the Tyne up to the colliery at Westall. And in places it was like 1 in 38 steep. But the overhead wires are probably at footpath level. As you look down, there's nothing left now. It's all been filled in.
Mm.
And there was a famous place called the Westall Bridges, which was on the other side of the line between Westall Lane and Chichester Road. And people who know the area will know what I mean. And you'd go into South Shields or go into Sheath, and all you'd get would be a glimpse of a cab and maybe a bit of arcing of a pantograph. And when we were going out as 17, 18, 19-year-olds, there was a set of sidings not too far away from one of the clubs we used to go to. And on the railway worked constantly Monday through Saturday. And on a Friday night, you could hear the trains moving and curves very tight, and they were screaming and the buffers were clanging. And there are a few things that make this railway interesting. The first one is when the low staves were rebuilt in 1914, they were set out to be worked almost entirely by gravity. And I'm not talking about discharging of coal, but in the way in which the trucks were moved. So one locomotive brought in a set of full wagons and uncoupled, and the rest of the entire operation, so running the full wagons down to the teaming shed, because this particular operation had a hopper that went to a conveyor so that you could better load the ships. You know, a couple of shunters ran all the fulls down. They were moved down to the teaming shed in a couple of wagons at a time, emptied, then run down again through a sprung point where the gradient changed.
Oh, so you use the momentum to run into the head shunt and then it rolls into the head back shunt on
and
itself.
Rolls back down onto the empties road.
Very clever.
But again, if you look on YouTube, you'll see some film, and the film shows the trains screaming out of the tunnel to get round the really tight curve and the raising gradient to go up. But they did have some problems with rolling stock. When there were two sets of staves, and in the 60s when the colliery and the National Coal Board had a central electricity generating board, CEGB, contract, they needed to bring coal in from other collieries. And when they used the 24.5-ton hoppers, when they were loaded, they could get them into through the tunnels. When they were unloaded and the springs came up, they couldn't.
Oh, that's a hard lesson to learn.
You can just imagine it, can't you? Some Geordie charge hand going, what's going on here? You could just imagine the skin and air that would must have been flying when that happened.
Yeah.
So they had to be very careful about what rolling stock they used. Again, Harton had its own workshops. The NCB were very loath to get rid of the electric locomotives because they couldn't replace them.
Yeah, what else are you going to use that's strong enough to deal with those gradients and corners and everything together?
Yeah, and at the end of the day, there's a fleet of about 15 locos of all types, Bobos and 040s for shunting. So it was a big old system. And it also had, we spoke about the other two pits, Bolden Colliery is about, I don't know, 5 miles away from the exchange sidings that were being used. Those trains were run again using NCB locomotives, NCB stock over British Railways metals. Now, I remember seeing as a child NCB trains waiting to cross on the flat crossing at a place called Pontop Crossing, waiting for the DMU that I was in going to Newcastle to go by. When you wind the clock back a bit further, there is film of NCB trains going one way and the Concert 9Fs with the ore trains going the other.
Oh, wow.
Because it was on the same line.
Whoa.
And the line that crossed on the flat at Pontop was effectively a secondary main line between Newcastle and Sunderland. And even in the 1980s, there were expresses, and there are still now, actually. There's a London train, but there were sleeper trains, expresses, and I guess when the main line wasn't used, diverted trains. So from a modelist perspective, it's gold dust.
Yeah, it's got everything.
Right, so it gets better, because at the South Shields end, the Whitburn end of the line was run by the South Shields, Marsden and Whitburn Colliery Railway. And it had a passenger service. And this passenger service was known locally as the Rattler. Largely because it used second-hand rolling stock and second-hand locomotives. And it was even in Bradshaw's.
Yeah.
And it had an interchange station with electric coal trains on one side and steam-hauled passenger trains on the other. And the Harton Coal Company used big engines, ex-Northeastern 060s. And the rolling stock came from places like the Great North of Scotland, Northeastern. It was well used, but it suffered failing fuel fortunes after the Second World War. But it was still being used enough for the NCB to commission three locomotives, two of which were built with this, to have vacuum brakes and Westinghouse pumps. And they were called, you can see like a builder's photograph, a saddle tank locomotive for passenger service. They were used for a bit, but at the same time, Westall Colliery was modernised. St Hilda's had closed in the 40s, and where the station was at a place called Westall Lane was becoming a bit of a bottleneck. And because you had to have a fully signalled system at the Marsden end, because there were also quarries at that end as well that they were moving stuff from, it was too much of a problem. So the passenger service stopped about 1953. And to put it into perspective, at that time, the NCB got about £5 worth of revenue for every 350 they got from coal.
Oh, wow. Yeah, not worth keeping that going.
No.
But they, I mean, it's amazing that they saw fit to order. I mean, there can't be many industrial locos that were ordered by businesses or like nationalised corporations like the NCB that were specced for passenger use.
No, very few. I don't know of any others, but I'm sure somebody out there in podcast land will know.
And I don't mean adapted from their original use, but this was specifically ordered with that purpose in mind.
But it said that the Houghton Coal Company, although they were very forward-leaning and used power and all that kind of thing, didn't want to spend any money. And when the NCB took over, the stock of the Rattler, as it was known locally, was pretty decrepit. And they got pretty much straight away some extra locomotives, some extra Ministry of Supply austerities. And I'm not sure they were that bothered about vacuum brakes, because there are pictures of an austerity on a passenger service that's got no continuous brake.
Okay.
But these were running quite quickly. 12 minutes to do the 3.5 miles from one end of the line to the other. And it was said that in the days of steam, some of the coal trains were worked at like 35, 40 miles an hour.
Wow.
Which is pretty quick for a unbraked train.
Yeah. Speaking about austerities, if anyone's actually been on the footplate of austerity at 25, it is...
They crash and bang a bit, don't they?
Yeah. Hold on for dear life.
And, you know, sort of wrap this up a bit, there is film out there of the same locomotives that were built for passenger service that were referred to as the Stubby Hawthorns, pulling trains of NCB hoppers in the 60s from Bolden Colliery down towards Tyne Dock. And the locomotives were being used then, and they were pretty dirty and past it by then. And there's even pictures out there of a K1 pulling an NCB train.
Oh, wow.
So again, you know, that I don't think it was all the same formula, but the Marsden Rattler has gone into local folklore. There's still a pub on the coast called the Rattler. We used to go there for drinks when we were kids. In terms of what's left, very little. Marsden Colliery, you would never know was there. There was an entire pit village on the side of on the cliffs at Marsden, and it's all gone. What is there, though, is the National Trust Souter Lighthouse, which kind of marks where the colliery was. And if you know, if you've seen the pictures, there's one row of houses that overlooked the colliery. In terms of the rest of it, very little left in South Shields, very little left, all flattened, filled in.
Well, if any listeners wanted to get a flavour of what the North East colliery railways were like, where would you suggest they visit?
Bowes, when it's open. Tanfield is a good place to have a look. Beamish gives a really good flavour of the North East in the round, but don't go to Beamish in one day thinking you're going to get all the way around it, because you won't.
Vast.
It's huge. There's a colliery village, a town. You get round by tram. You can see people cooking on open ranges. They've even built a 1950s sort of council estate now. Mm. They've got a coal-fired chippy at Beamish.
Oh, nice.
Davy's fried fish.
I've seen pictures of that one.
Well, my kids love it. My daughter, when she was 16, she did her work experience at Beamish as a costumed engager in the town, dressed as like an Edwardian lady. And there's a sweet shop. And the lad that works in the sweet shop, his name was Bon Bon. And he was a big... And we'd gone to see her because she was like with a basket, and grandma had given her a basket to carry, all that kind of thing, and a hat. And the fish shop was only just opened. And this lad came out, and it was a sweltering hot day, and he was sweating like buggery. And he went, "There's a 45-minute wait for chips. We use curl. The heat is not instantaneous." And we just went back in, and all these people, there was a whole coachload of guys from somewhere like Kent, and they went, "What did he just say? What was that? What's he speaking? Is he Polish?" No, mate, he's not. And if you want to see a big engine, the Lambton tank engines are running on the North Yorkshire Moors Railway. North Tyneside Steam Railway, that's where my dad has been a volunteer for probably 30 years plus now, has got the Stevenson long boiler that came from Consett. It's got Ashington Coal Company, Peckett.
Built in Bristol.
Yeah, built in Bristol, yeah, I'll give you that. It's got an RSH that was an Ashington engine. It's got one of the Bagnalls that were built for the Steel Company of Wales, and are they really Gucci bits of kit.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and the other ones across at Lakeside.
Yeah.
And I was a fireman over there, and so have a bit of a relationship with those guys. And I think if you get a flavour for all of them, it's worth going. North Tyneside is only small, but it's got some really interesting exhibits.
Packed, yeah.
Yeah. they're friendly. If you're interested, they'll talk to you forever. It's a sort of a part of our history that I think is generational. My generation remember it. I think the people that come behind probably have no idea.
No. And it's right under your feet.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, literally. 400 years worth. But it's been a pleasure to discuss it. I could talk forever. You've probably got far too much to deal with, but...
I think we'll do all right.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on the show, Nick, and for talking to us. I really hope we can have you back again.
Well, yeah. Why not?
Let's talk more about trains.
What can we talk about next?
Oh, whatever we want.
Railways and war?
Yeah.
I can do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Thank you very much.